and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Northern Limits, a 4,000-mile human-powered journey. Hosted by the Wilderness Society and Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, Caroline Van Hemert and Patrick Farrell shared stories from their 2012 adventure, traveling on foot and by boat from Bellingham, Washington to Kotzebue, Alaska, at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage on April 16th.
All right, great. Well, I'll get things started. Big crowd out there. I know there's a lot of backcountry experience out there in the audience, and I appreciate you coming out on such a nice evening. So this here is what we're going to talk about tonight, the trip we did last year, and basically a journey from Puget Sound down to Washington State, arcing up across Alaska to a nice little town there, Kotzebue, on the shores of the Chukchi Sea. But first, I thought I would just give a little background on us and sort of our adventure history together, and then kind of how we came about designing this trip. Right out of high school, I came up here and built this squatter's cabin. I'm up in the interior of Alaska, and for me, it had been, I guess, a childhood dream to come to Alaska ever since I was a little kid, and I'll live out in the woods and spend a lot of time alone, I guess. And so that's kind of what I did, and, looking for wild places is sort of why I came to Alaska, and I felt like I found it. But, I ended up going down to school in Washington, where I met Ashley's older sister, Caroline, and we've been doing trips ever since. Most of our trips have been more mountain-focused, usually climbing, skiing in Alaska and Canada. But for us, the trips that really stood out as memorable to us are trips that we kind of mixed up the environments we were in and even the mode of transportation. Particularly the alpine glaciated environment with other environments like the marine environment of the sea. An early trip we did, kind of combining these different things, was when we were living down in Bellingham, Washington. We were on a little sailboat going to school up at the campus there and sailed up the coast of BC to the end of this fjord and climbed Mount Waddington from the coast. It was a really cool trip. Another trip I'll mention that kind of influenced this larger trip we did last year is we climbed Mount Fairweather here in Alaska and then skied and down climbed to the Gulf of Alaska and then walked the Lost Coast for a couple hundred miles to Gustavus. And it was a really cool trip too. And on these longer trips, we really got an itch for, I guess, moving across this sort of mixed, challenging terrain that we're seldomly visited. And Caroline was just finishing up her PhD in biology, and the time seemed right for us to try something on a really big scale. And so early on, we decided we wanted to do a traverse. And this differed a little bit from past trips in that a lot of the trips, like this one here, were coming out of a climbing trip in the Mendenhall Towers outside of Juneau, Alaska, and just packs full of techno climbing gear and just sort of stumbling along. And we decided on this trip to leave all that stuff behind and try to go really light and just explore some of the wildest places we could find. And so we started identifying just major geographical features we wanted to check out. And one that came to mind right away was the Inside Passage. You know, we had spent time on either end of it, first, you know, down south in Bellingham with our boat and doing a lot of climbing in the Cascades, and then later built a cabin and have done quite a few trips outside of Haines, Alaska. So that was definitely on the list. Another goal of ours was to do a traverse of the Brooks Range. And we thought if we could get up there early enough, we might be able to just make that happen. And if we could link these two areas together by way of this, we wanted to connect this other tributary, which shortly after we met the first summer there, we did this really epic trip for us in the Yukon River, where we built this canoe and had a little starving involved and that sort of stuff. And it was a real big thing for us. And so we wanted to link through that drainage. It was a little bit of a detour, but that was a goal of ours. And then a beach walk, similar to what we did on the Gulf of Alaska, but this time on the Arctic coast. And this would bring us right into Anwar, the cabin grounds of the Porcupine Caribou Herd. And finally, to close the gap, a ski tour over the Coast Range. And so this is basically the concept of our trip. It'd be one project that would go linking places we've really grown to love over the years to these distant places we always wanted to check out. And the neat thing about it was there was just so many places in between that weren't even on our radar that were just so incredible. And I remember for me, the sort of size of the trip really hit me in the gut when I was pinning all these maps of the Brooks Range on the bedroom wall, and they started getting so crooked, and I stepped back and realized I hadn't considered the curvature of the earth when I was pinning them up, and whoa. And so in trying to get a handle on the mileage, and we calculated it all up time and time again and came to numbers right around 4,000. You know, it sounded like a lot, but what is 4,000? And pulled out the road atlas and saw we could go drive from Seattle to Miami, Florida, and that'd be less than 4,000. And but then what we were trying to do, we weren't going to use roads, man-made hiking trails, bridges, and there are a few communities in between to resupply at. You know, all these things were why we were super excited about it, of course. And so we tried to tailor each mode of transportation to whatever best suited the region. And this, of course, was a bit of a game of compromise, largely just logistics of getting the right boat to the right area, and which became increasingly more difficult as we got to northern latitudes. But we tried to keep it as simple as possible, relying the majority of the time on just the postal service to mail our supplies to and that sort of thing. But for the first section of the trip, we wanted to try rowing instead of sea kayaking, which we've done in the past, for a variety of reasons, but mainly just wanted to use our legs, and this seemed like a really good trip to sort of make the jump and try it. Problem was we didn't have rowboats, and it turns out you can't just go down to REI and buy an expedition rowboat. So over the winter, starting in like December, with the help of friends, we built two boats in Eric's shop here, and we were pretty busy before leaving last winter. But as the paint was still drying, we shipped the boats down from here in Anchorage to Washington. The oars came from Vancouver. And here we are the day before the trip, putting it all together for the very first time in Bellingham. The boats had never seen water, and we'd never seen boats like this before. So I'll turn it over to Caroline for the next section.
So here we are leaving Bellingham Bay in a hailstorm, and for anyone in the audience who might be a rower, you might notice that Pat's form is not ideal. And our friends Tom and Celeste were kind of waving us off, and we're both trying really hard to look less desperate than we felt. But we didn't even know how to row these things in a straight line. It was pretty bad. And so we're thinking, before we've even really left, like, what have we just signed up for? We might have just screwed ourselves for the next 6 months. So we had a lot of uncertainty at this point. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Inside Passage, it extends from Puget Sound all the way up to northern southeast Alaska. It's about 1,200-mile marine waterway that's largely protected by a chain of islands. But as we would soon discover, there's still lots of open water passages and pretty exposed sections of coastline. And kind of right off the bat, it became quickly apparent that our biggest adversary on this leg was going to be weather. We got hammered, I think, with three gales in the first 10 days, which left us pretty much just totally on edge. We had, like I said, didn't really know how to row. We didn't know the thresholds of our boats yet, and we didn't know quite what we could handle. So every morning we kind of crawled out of the tent just feeling like we were getting ready to do battle, and again, wondering, what did we just get ourselves into? And then the other problem with these big storm systems is they left us stuck on shore for days at a time. So meanwhile, all of our gear is being shipped to the Arctic, and we're just sitting there waiting, hoping the weather's going to break. But on days like this, I think in this particular occasion, even the BC ferries were canceled. So there's absolutely no chance that we were going to be going out with our little rowboats with any margin of safety. So these storms kind of took their toll on us, both physically and mentally, as you can imagine. But I think in retrospect, they actually kind of saved us. One of our biggest concerns on a trip like this was the potential for developing stress or overuse injuries. And being forced to sit and rest for a day or even 2 or 3 days really helped our bodies kind of heal and recover in between these bouts of rowing. And fortunately, there were enough days like this that were just perfectly calm and gorgeous that we really came to kind of love rowing as much as we didn't know what we were doing. We figured it out pretty quickly. For those of you who skate ski, I think it's kind of analogous to that just in terms of the pull and the glide. And it's an incredibly fluid and pretty efficient means of travel. And then the other big consideration on this section was just the fact of tides and currents. So obviously, there's water like constantly moving in and out of the system, and so every day our schedule is really set by the demands of the ocean. So sometimes all this water funneling around islands and up and down channels can create pretty intense currents like whirlpools and tidal rapids and that sort of thing, which are just not navigable in a small boat. In a lot of other cases, it was just a matter of efficiency. We only could travel at a few knots at the most in these little boats, so if you have a current opposing you at the same speed, it's basically just a waste of energy to even try. Sometimes this meant we would row until well after dark or get up at 3 or 4 in the morning to start every day. Because if we didn't pay attention, this is us just outside of Juneau and Gastineau Canal or Channel, and we basically just ran out of water. So here we are dragging our boats through ankle-deep water instead of rowing along like we should have been. And then kind of at the other extreme, the tidal fluctuations, just like they are around here, are huge. So we're talking like, 20 feet or something. And we also learned from locals, like several weeks later, that these were some of the biggest tides they had seen in something like 10 years. So we were dealing with a lot of water moving in and out. And this often meant we had to haul our boats way up these slippery rocks to the kind of highest place we could find so that they wouldn't float away while we were sleeping. And this generally worked pretty well. But there was one night, we hauled our boats up to the top of this big log jam, went to bed like usual, and I woke up at about 2 or 3 in the morning to this really weird sort of hollow clanging sound. And it took me a minute first just to figure out where I was and then what the sound could possibly be. And then I realized it was all of those driftwood logs bashing around in the surf, which was not a good thing because that is where we left our boats. So I shouted for Pat to wake up, and we kind of stumbled through this floating log jam, just dreading what we were going to find. And as we rounded the corner, we got lucky because our boats were on the one log that was not floating. And so we just barely squeaked by in that occasion. And it's kind of funny because the next day we arrived in Bella Bella, another community where we were going to resupply. And I was pretty excited to call and check in with my family and, of course, tell them about our epic night. And instead, I learned that at the same time that we were bobbing around in the surf, my sister was in labor with her first child. And suddenly, our story was a lot less exciting. And she can probably attest, I won't put her on the spot here in the audience, that her night was a little bit more epic than mine. But the same things that make travel in the system so challenging also makes it an incredibly neat place to travel. It's super dynamic, changing like literally from 1 hour to the next. This is a mussel bed at low tide. And the upside of coming through in the early spring, even though we were dealing with a lot of stormy weather, is the fact that it's an incredibly productive time. This is a picture of herring eggs. We came through right at the peak of herring spawn. And these eggs would wash up in the millions in these huge foamy yellow mats, which was just incredible to see. And to kind of add to that, we also saw tons of wildlife that were all congregated in the area to feed on the herring. These are stellar sea lions, as most of you probably know. And these were some of our most entertaining rowing companions. They would follow us for long periods of time. They're super curious and playful and really, really noisy. And this is a big flock of surf scoters. And these sea ducks will congregate in rafts of thousands. And it's really incredible to watch them all dive in synchrony when they're feeding on herring or whatever else is in the area. And the other thing about this species that was especially interesting for us is that we followed them all the way from Puget Sound to the Arctic. And for me as a biologist, it was really fun to not just see what they're doing kind of on one end or on the other end, but to actually see how they move across the landscape. And it actually turned out to be really similar to what we were doing. And as we're kind of getting close to the end of this first big leg, this is us nearing Northern Lynn Canal, we're excited about the fact that we pulled it off, first of all. And second of all, our first destination is our cabin. And so as it's getting stormier and colder and wetter, we just have our eyes on the wood stove. And so we finally pulled up on our beach, and I think this day it was about 39 degrees and sleeting. We were pretty excited about taking a little break and kind of gearing up for the next leg.
All right. So I'll admit it was a little hard to pull ourselves away from the wood stove and head out into a world of snow and ice, but then again, this section was one we were really looking forward to. On the lower left hand of the screen there is the north end of the Inside Passage, the ocean, and on the upper right, the lakes we were trying to get to. You just see the amount of glaciation in this region. And it was a really neat position to be in, you know, sitting there on our beach and looking over at these mountains. Like a lot of other times, but this year was the year we were going to just try to climb up over them and go all the way to the Arctic coast. So we totally mixed it up from here, changed out all of our gear, and left the boats at the cabin. And the biggest change now is everything has to be able to go on our backs. And we took these pack rafts, these little inflatable boats that are pretty amazing, and we'd use these for the ocean crossing, and then on the other side of the range to go down a river and across a chain of lakes. We also brought sort of a midway pair of ski gear that we used to cross these glaciers, and also brought various glacier travel equipment, rope, harness, crampons, this sort of thing. So all this gear plus like 10 days of food trying to cover a little over 180 miles made for pretty heavy packs right off the bat. But a big concern of ours was actually avalanches. We had anticipated more of a spring snowpack this time of year down there, but the previous storm cycle that hit us as we were traveling from Juneau up to our cabin dumped like 6 feet of snow on the coast range. And because of this, we ended up altering our route a bit. avoiding some higher, colder snow and instead opting for this lower route. The lower routes always pose their own challenges, though, and that is, as a lot of you probably know, if, like, anytime you're getting on and off a glacier, that interface between the glacier and the rock or dirt or whatever can be kind of tricky. In this instance here, we did happen to find this bridge onto the glacier. This lake at the terminus of the glacier actually drains right under where Caroline's walking. There's this bridge of ice with all this rock on it. And after a couple attempts, we made it up onto the ice. And here we are after skiing for a while, and we're taking a break right on the border of Canada. And it was pretty neat to be there on this kind of nondescript pass and tip our skis down into a totally different ecosystem. You know, we've been in the coastal rainforest of spruce and cedars and hemlocks, and now to come to these open pine forests, and it was a nice day too. It was so neat. So we worked our way down, and till we hit water, and we kind of skis on and off again terrain, worked our way around this gorge, until finally we put in this river. And for this section, we didn't really have any information on the river, these mountain passes, and a lot of the other stuff. So it really made for an adventurous leg coming through this region. Here Caroline is on these lakes in Canada, the Yukon Territory, and wearing ski boots and carrying the skis long after we left the snow. You can see the buds on the trees behind there are just about to burst. And
so we did make it to Whitehorse in time to go chomping around the grocery store in our ski boots. And when the post office opened the next morning, we were pretty excited to swap those out for a pair of lightweight hiking shoes. And this is kind of the point on the trip when the whole concept of going light and fast would really start to set in. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Yukon. It's about the same size as the state of California, but the big difference is only 30,000 people live there. So it's a pretty remote, extremely sparsely populated region. And that red line there shows you our route through it. And all this, like Pat mentioned, is basically going to be off-trail, so all backcountry travel. And up here, that can mean a lot of different things. Sometimes it means something like this, which is excellent, where you have good footing, pretty open country, not much brush. And this is kind of what we were picturing for the Tombstone Mountains early on in the Yukon. But in mid-June, this is what we found. In almost all of the passes in all the higher country, we were post-holing in thigh or waist-deep snow for miles. And alternatively, when we dropped down into the valleys, because it was midsummer, things had already leafed out, so it was a lot of really thick bushwhacking. So we ended up spending a lot of our energy kind of trying to find that sweet spot in the terrain, if there was one. So kind of thinking like an animal, where, you know, could we find the right elevation where we could actually move efficiently? And along the way, our feet got totally beat up. So we'd just come off of boating for more than 2 months, and suddenly we're kind of dealing with, yeah, pretty rough terrain and a lot of blisters. And these plagued us well into the trip. But fortunately, kind of like with the rowing, we eventually started to find our groove. We figured out where to travel and then alternatively where not to travel. And we're actually able to start making some pretty good time. And part of what enabled this was that we started to get into some rivers. And so not only did we get a chance to give our feet a break, get off of them and let them heal, it also just kept things really interesting. We didn't really know much about any of these rivers, and so we never knew what was going to be around the next bend. And so this kept our energy level high, just kind of constantly engaged with what was happening. And along the way, in kind of classic Yukon style, we came across lots of artifacts. Many of them were from the Gold Rush era, as you can imagine. And this cabin in particular was really entertaining. The whole place was just plastered with these pinups, like you can see on the left, which I guess are sort of like late 1800s version of girly magazines. And they were just everywhere, so that's pretty entertaining. And then the other part of the reason that we wanted to come back to this area, and Pat kind of alluded to this earlier, was the fact that we had our own personal history here. So almost exactly 10 years prior, we had hiked in to the headwaters of the Wind River, a pretty remote place. And this was kind of an early attempt at going light, where we didn't bring a boat in. We just brought the tools that we needed to build the boat. And it turned out not to be the lightest proposition after all. We needed about 2 months' worth of food. And so we carried that in on our backs. We had to double carry. And it turned out that that wasn't actually 2 months' worth of food. So that's where the starvation part came in. But we did manage to build a bark canoe, and we pulled it off, but it was one of those just barely kind of things. But still, it was a pretty formative adventure for us, and so we were really excited about the idea of returning to the exact same place 10 years later. But this time around, we knew we had to do it in really different style. We needed to actually move quickly. And the thing that really made this possible for us was the pack raft. So these boats, I know a lot of you have probably used them or at least seen them, are pretty incredible. They only weigh about 7 pounds fully loaded. And so this really allowed us to take advantage of the contours of the landscape. So rather than, you know, seeing a river or hitting a river and just seeing it as an obstacle, we're actually able to hop in and take advantage of the fact that the water was moving. And then alternatively, when we needed to switch drainages or hike over a pass, we weren't stuck portaging a really heavy canoe or kayak, but could just roll up these little boats, put them on our backs, and keep moving. And it was kind of this mix of constant boating and walking that really characterized a lot of our time in the Yukon.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Caroline Van Hemert and Patrick Farrell. The couple traveled from Bellingham, Washington to Kotzebue, Alaska in 2012. Their presentation about the trip, including photos and videos, which you can find at alaskapublic.org, was recorded at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage on April 16th.
So, you know, on every trip, you know there's going to be some real low points. Yeah, boy, the Mackenzie Delta really really gave us a real run for our money. And it wasn't that it was, like, physically the most demanding or it was really scary and stressful. It was just so miserable. And, yeah, really the problem was for the first time in the trip, we started to ask ourselves, like, what are we doing? And questioning why we were even out there. And, you know, when the soul of the trip starts to fall apart a bit, boy, everything becomes so difficult. And there was 1,000 places we'd rather be. We kind of had a logistical challenge. We wanted to connect these river systems in Canada with the Arctic coast. And, just jump in the Mackenzie Delta and, it'll spit us out in the Arctic Ocean. Boy, it was bad because the main problem was the winds up there blow off the Arctic Ocean. And they can blow like that for a long time. So much so that it changes the water level in the delta and reverses the flow even. And we were in pack rafts, which do very poorly on flat water. And against the headwind, it's like maddeningly slow, like half a mile an hour, a mile an hour. And so we just were kind of wallowing through this maze of channels. And it was muddy and buggy and that sort of thing. But at times the wind did stop, though. And when it stopped, we just knew we couldn't. We would just go, like 18 hours straight in the boat, never getting out. We'd pee from the boats and everything. And finally, like this picture is probably 2 or 3 in the morning or something, and finally we did, towards the edge of the delta, we were able to get out and walk portions of it, which really helped.
So, if anyone's planning a trip this summer, it's a great place for ducks, but maybe not a good place for a vacation. So we finally did make it to the Arctic coast, and we showed up there just kind of sleep-deprived and totally wide-eyed at suddenly being able to see again. And almost immediately, when we reached the Delta, it felt like we were in a place unlike any we had ever been. There's this huge storm cloud just billowing overhead. And at this point, it's probably midnight. We're kind of looking for a place to camp. We're tired. And kind of out of the corner of our eye, we just see a little bit of motion. And we turn around, and there's this huge grizzly just barreling down on us. We didn't really know where it had come from, what it was doing, other than running straight at us. And so we're just kind of bracing for impact after seeing nothing but mud and brush for the previous 3 weeks. This was kind of the last thing that we were expecting. But luckily, it must have either caught our scent or realized what we were and kind of abruptly changed direction and went running off across the delta away from us, luckily. But meanwhile, the big storm cloud that was billowing overhead started to dump rain and hail on us, and so we made a pretty quick decision to set up our tent next to this big driftwood log. And so we crawled in and kind of waited out the storm. And then when it finally passed, we got out. And at this point, we're really ready for something to eat. It's probably 2 in the morning. But when we got out, we noticed this really strange smell. And it didn't take very long to realize it was coming from the carcass of a bearded seal that was just about a dozen feet away from us. And so we kind of put 2 and 2 together and decided that was probably not a very good place to camp, considering that the bear had been coming from that general direction. So as much as we didn't want to, we packed up our tent and our stuff and got on the boats and started paddling. And things were feeling a little bit surreal already. It didn't help that the sky was totally wild. The sun was still up, of course. There was a nearly full moon rising. There was a rainbow across one side of the horizon, and then there was lightning still flashing across the other side. And so we're kind of in this really strange zone, paddling along. And then we noticed these two objects pretty far offshore in the distance, and we couldn't tell what they were at first. And then we get a little bit closer and realize that they're moose standing in the Arctic Ocean about a half mile offshore, which was really strange and definitely not what we were expecting. And so we're thinking, okay, well, we are in a very different place now. So we're paddling around, you know, kind of giving a pretty wide berth, and they're kind of watching us, and at this point it's just a total novelty to see moose in the Arctic Ocean. And then they start to walk toward us just a few steps at a time, still don't think much of it. And then they start to walk after us pretty determinedly. And you can see they're only standing in about knee-deep water. The ocean up there is really different from the Pacific or something. The shallows extend sometimes for like a mile offshore. And so these guys are walking like there's not even any water there. Meanwhile, we're paddling our sluggish little boats, kind of touching bottom every stroke. And they're kind of gaining on us. And so we start paddling a lot harder. And then finally we get into deeper water and are able to get ahead of them just a little bit. But it turns out they swam after us for close to a mile, which was incredible and just kind of added to the feeling of being in a really surreal landscape. And so this is a picture of a map from that particular section. And it's the kind of thing that really wouldn't make any sort of sense if you weren't there. Looked like somebody, you know, made those notations who were in a very different mental state, which maybe we were. But we realized pretty quickly that the maps up there are sort of, at best, a historical approximation. That coastline is changing so quickly, and none of these have been updated since the 1950s. So really, the coastline looks totally different. We had kind of an interesting visit with an Inuvialuit family at their whaling camp up there. They invited us in for some caribou soup, and we stopped and visited for a while. And as we were leaving, the mother said something that really kind of stuck with us. She said, you know, we talked about where we were going and kind of our general plan for the trip, which I'm sure they thought was totally crazy. But she didn't say, I hope you make it to Kotzebue, or even I hope you make it to Herschel Island, which was our next destination. But she just said, I hope you make it where you're going. And that seemed like a perfect kind of way to describe our movement across this landscape. And so we kind of use that as a mantra as we went along the Arctic coast. And if, for anyone who's been up on the Arctic coast, you know that these mud bluffs are a really major feature up there. And they're eroding incredibly quickly, in some places up to about 100 feet a year. And they're just literally falling down in front of our eyes. Here I'm looking at a deer falcon nest perched way out on the edge of that bluff there. And just as an example of how quickly these things are changing, we came across, this is a rough-legged chick, and its entire nest had just slid right down the bluff, probably just days before we came upon it. And so these things are changing so, so quickly. As we went further west, we started to travel more and more on these spits or barrier islands and these incredibly long, narrow stretches of sand and gravel. And they sit just inches above the tide line. Again, very different from the Pacific. The tidal fluctuations up there are something like a foot. So you hardly even notice if it's high or low tide. And this was excellent walking out on these spits or islands. But the biggest problem we had was just a lack of fresh water. And we often had to go way out of our way to find it. And then when we did, we would carry sometimes days' worth on our backs. We did have a lot of driftwood for fires, which was pretty handy. And it was really interesting to think about where these pieces of wood had come from. There are no trees whatsoever in that landscape. And so you probably noticed in that picture previously where we had our tent, these enormous logs that come from hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away. And then another really interesting thing on some of these spits were these bones. Some places it looked like somebody had taken an entire museum collection, just dumped it on the beach. And so it was pretty neat to kind of wander through these graveyards and see everything that was there or had been there in the past. And as we crossed back into Alaska, across the Canadian border, we started to come across more and more of these huge icebergs, and in some cases, big sections of shore-fast ice. And all along this coastline, there was just so many different interesting things to see. We never really knew from one day to the next what we might stumble on.
So my mother-in-law, Rose, would sneak some treats into those boxes, so as you were seeing there. So we left Kaktovik and headed south for the first time on the entire trip, which felt a little odd. Basically, our plan was to head down into the Brooks Range and then cut west across. And, the Brooks Range is just quite an amazing place. Many people feel it's one of the wildest places left on the planet, and it was pretty neat to kind of head into it in this part of the trip. The first thing I'll mention is just water, and going across it, you got to deal with a lot of water, a lot of creeks every single day. And but because we stayed so close to the crest of the range on the eastern portion, we decided to mail our rafts from Arctic Village to Anaktuvuk Pass to save weight. And this worked pretty well. Most of the time, the rivers weren't any deeper than waist deep, and we were able to wade across. There was, however, one river, the Chandelier River, that we swam across. And we were a little concerned on how cold the water was, and we knew we'd be in there for a while. And so we decided to wear a lot of clothing. We even wore these spare trash bags we had from our packs, and basically just to keep our body heat close. And I think it did keep us warmer, but I found it kind of hard to swim with all that clothing on, as you can imagine. But Caroline came up with this great stroke where she pushed her pack with her chin and did this breaststroke. And myself, my technique wasn't quite as good. I had my pack with one hand and did this one-arm crawl. I just got really tired with all that water in my arm, but it did work. We got across. I put the camera on the pack, so I got some great footage of it. But and the last thing I'll mention is just there's a lot of water on the landscape up there. Of course, because it's permafrost, it doesn't drain like soils around here. And because of that, we just wore running shoes. They stood a chance of drying out more, and mainly, it was just so much lighter than wet hiking boots. And so, by this time of the trip, we really feel like we shed most everything we didn't need. We, had sent our rafts on. The clothes Caroline's wearing is pretty much everything she has. We stopped carrying a stove quite a while ago and just had sort of the food we thought we would need to get to the next resupply. All these things came back to bite us a bit later on. But for right now, it made for great travel. We were really light on our feet and just cruising along. And really the key to traveling up there, we found, was our route. And this was both on a really big scale, like which valleys and ridges and that sort of thing to take, but then also on this real micro level. And the key to that are these. And you're looking at the trails left by the caribou. And, yeah, it was just a really moving experience just following these trails for so long. And we really had to let go of sort of our own intuition of where to go and trust these trails. It really played itself out so many times. An example might be we'd be following trails along a river, going along a riverbed, and we'd lose a trail. And a lot of times the trails aren't as obvious as they are here in this pass, but sometimes you can't even see them, you just feel them under your feet. But we'd lose the trail and say, oh, the trail probably crossed the river. But you know, we knew we had to be on that side of the river in 5 miles anyway, and we'll just bushwhack along, we'll probably come back. And then we'd like round the bend and there'd be a cliff that come right down to the water. And we'd be like, you know, we should have at least crossed where it was shallow. But it really like played itself out so many times. But if, I guess at one place on the trip that, where the size of landscape just made us feel so small, is this zone. And we just felt like ants crawling across this wilderness. And, you know, in some ways we felt so small, but in other ways felt maybe a little naively bigger than life. I mean, if the delta was kind of the low point of the trip, I feel like this was the real high point. Now we're about halfway across the Brooks Range. You know, this plan of ours seems to be working. And we just felt stronger than we felt in our lives. And, yeah, just going across these ridge after ridge and looking out as far as we can see. And like, okay, well, that's where we're headed in 5 days. And we get there and look over again.
So, yeah, like Pat said, we were feeling pretty good at this point, pretty confident, maybe a little overconfident. Because at this point in the trip, after 5 months of moving, something changed really dramatically. It was like the land had kind of flexed its muscles, and we started to unravel a little bit in the process. Our first problem was the weather. We had 28 straight days of rain and snow. And I don't know if any of you remember last year in August, the sort of Arctic superstorm and all the flooding and that was reported around Red Dog Mine and some of those areas. We were kind of right in the thick of that. And as a result, everything was totally flooded. And so it made all those crossings really stressful and really difficult every day. Of course, we were soaking wet and cold all the time. And even just simple things like making dinner became really difficult because we didn't have anything to cook with except the little bits of wood that were available. And this up in this environment is basically willow and alder. And it was so saturated that we couldn't get a fire going to save our lives. So at this point, we're pretty wet and kind of miserable and feeling a little bit down on our luck. And then, to make matters worse, we had a really scary encounter with a predatory bear. So, like many of you, I'm sure, have worked and lived in Alaska for a lot of years and met a lot of bears along the way. And I've sort of heard anecdotally about these predatory bears that stalk people and things like that. But it was shocking to me how obvious it was when we actually met one. And what happened here is we were walking through pretty thick brush, and we're just kind of coming out into an open clearing. And I heard a little rustling in the bushes behind me and didn't really think a whole lot of it, but I turned around to see what it was. And there was a bear, it was about 15 feet from me, coming straight at me. And all I really had time to do was sort of throw one arm up in the air and shout and hope that it would either realize what I was, if it hadn't already, or at least kind of give it a moment's pause. And it did stop about 5 feet from me, but instead of running the other direction like I was hoping, it just kind of turned broadside, which is sort of an aggressive posture, and continued to stare at me. And by this time, Pat, of course, realized what was going on and had his bear spray out, and I had my bear spray out. And we're just kind of having this standoff, trying to see what the bear's next move was going to be and then what we should do. And the bear finally kind of very slowly sauntered off, but it was very unconvincing. And the fact that it had been coming up from behind us made us think that it was probably stalking us, so we didn't really want to let it out of our sight. And sure enough, within, you know, just 30 seconds or a minute, it circled back around and approached us to within a few feet. And it did this over and over again. It turned into about a 30-minute standoff. And we threw our poles at it. We shouted at it. We sprayed it with bear spray. We did just about anything we could think of to try to convince it was not going to be. We weren't going to be an easy meal. And it took a lot of convincing. But fortunately, it eventually decided it wasn't worth the trouble and kind of wandered off enough that we felt like we could make our way to this river that was nearby and hop in our boats and cover some ground. And so it turned out okay, but it definitely left us feeling a little bit less comfortable in bear country. It's not the kind of bear you want to meet when you're sleeping in your tent or something like that. And then our next problem on this section was snow. We had, at this point, we're just coming, trying to get out of the Aragetch Valley, and this was our second failed attempt to cross this pass. And we still had quite a few high elevation passes to get over before we made it to the Noatak Valley. And in this case, we ended up having to backtrack and take a much longer and sort of brushier way around, which was obviously demoralizing. The other problem was we were getting kind of short on food. And so that kind of light and fast mode that Pat mentioned was starting to kind of catch up with us. And yeah, so we're kind of operating on half rations, just sleeping wet and cold every single night. But at this point, we knew we somehow had to find a way over the mountains. We were so close, and we weren't ready to give up, and we also didn't have another great alternative for getting ourselves out of there other than by our own means. So we knew there had to be a way. And eventually we found one. This is coming down the other side of a pass that's going to take us into the Noatak Valley. And it's a little bit hard to get a clear sense from this picture, just a sense of scale, but these blocks are pretty huge. Some of them are like the size of small cars. And they sit at incredibly steep angles, and when they're snow-covered, it just felt like this sort of mile-long, treacherous journey through this never-ending field of talus. But when we finally got down to the other side in the Noatak Valley, it felt like probably the biggest accomplishment on the entire trip. We sort of felt like we had arrived. All we had left to do at this point was to get a final resupply and boat the river. And at this point, that seemed like a pretty doable proposition. But as these things tend to go, the Brooks Range was not ready to let us off quite that easily. This was the one place on the entire trip that we used air support, and just about ended in disaster. So we got to the Noatak River. At this point, we're down to just a few granola bars, pretty ready to get our resupply. We had that very brief break in the weather, which you saw in the last picture, which, of course, promptly shut down. And we started this really nasty waiting game. So the same bad weather that had been, you know, preventing us from getting over the passes meant that the pilot coming from the other side of the range from Bettles was not able to make it to us. And so we ended up waiting for almost 5 days, just kind of sitting, biding our time, getting more and more concerned about the fact that as we got weaker, we weren't going to be able to deal with any situations that might arise. And the hardest thing was just not knowing how long we'd be sitting there. You know, I think in any other situation, even in Southeast Alaska, we would have figured, oh, well, it's been, you know, a few days, a week. The weather's got to break sometime. But we knew that around there, the weather had some serious staying power. But we finally got enough of a break that the pilot snuck in, dropped off our food, and I think we ate more in the first 15 minutes than we had in the preceding week, probably. And we're finally able to get on the river and continue making our way. And after a few days of boating, we kind of came to the conclusion that being delayed like that was probably the luckiest thing that could have possibly happened, because it meant that we had the opportunity to cross paths with the Western Arctic caribou herd on their fall migration. So here they are swimming the Noatak River. And we watched thousands and thousands and thousands of animals cross this river until well after dark, and it was really incredible experience. And it was especially neat because we'd been following, not necessarily this herd, but caribou for so much of the time we'd been in the Brooks Range. And so to finally see them kind of in motion on their migration was a really powerful way to kind of end. So rather than try to put words to the final bit of the trip, I'll show you the last video.
Come on there! The bear has been... Yeah, I came running up behind Caroline and turned around and met it, and then it left off, and then it came back for more. We sprayed with bear spray. I just don't know. I mean, it seemed like if it was really aggressive and wanted to, like, get us. just waiting for an opportunity, maybe. Go on! Go on there! Day four of the waiting game. Had a good meal. As we went 2 days over on the last leg, so that was stretched pretty thin, and then now we've just been cutting our food thinner and thinner. It's one granola bar a day, which we've got two more left, so it's been kind of a wet 3 days and 10. Today, the first day, it's clouds have risen a bit. There's snow on top of the peaks. Hoping that the rain comes in sometime today. See, try not to get your hopes up too much.
KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Caroline Van Hemert and Patrick Farrell. The couple traveled from Bellingham, Washington to Kotzebue, Alaska in 2012. Hosted by the Wilderness Society and Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, their presentation, entitled Northern Limits, A 4,000-Mile Human-Powered Journey, was recorded at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage on April 16, 2013. To see some of their amazing photos and videos, go to alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.